From the four corners of Southern California, this is the Hot Seat and Urinate with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now, today on the phone, as the finale to the day's legislator interview special guests. I have State Senator from the 26th District, Holly Mitchell. How are you, Senator Mitchell? Thank you very much for taking the time to call into the Hot Seat this afternoon.
I appreciate the opportunity, Max. It's great to be with you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you. And I would like to note that the 26th Senatorial District includes USC. Because I have a lot of questions and do not want to say any more, let's get started.
Let's go.
You are formerly in the Assembly, so how do you like being in the Senate, and what is similar and what is different?
Yes, Max, you're right. I spent 3 years representing first the 47th Assembly District and the 54th. I had the opportunity to run in a special election this past fall to fill the unexpired seat of Curran Price, who vacated early to run for L.A. City Council. So I've just been in the Senate since this past September, which was during interim, and so I didn't join all of my colleagues until we came back in January. So it's just been about 2 months. It's probably more different than the average person would expect. You know, the size of the Senate is about half. We've got 40 versus the 80 in the Assembly. And that really creates a very different dynamic just in terms of your opportunity to get to know your colleagues. You know, it's fewer votes, quite frankly, that you have to hustle on the floor to get a bill passed. It's, you know, different leadership. So I'm forging and forming new relationships as I get to know kind of the culture of the Senate and my new colleagues. But I'm really looking forward to it. If the voters continue to support me, I'll have an opportunity to serve for 9 years to represent the constituents. So it gives me a nice bit of time to get to know my colleagues and be an effective legislator in the Senate.
Okay. And do you believe you have more power than you did when you were in the Assembly?
That's an interesting question, Max. More power. I think, you know, the Senate is referred to as the upper house, the upper chamber. And again, I think that has a lot to do with the terms of service are longer. It's 4 years versus 2 years, half the size. And I think for myself, given the fact that I was appointed to the Senate Rules Committee and given the power the Rules Committee carries, I think at this point in my elected career, I would say that I've got pretty significant power, particularly coming in as a freshman member of the Senate.
Yes, and we're going to get into the Rules Committee a little bit later, but congratulations to you on being appointed there. Were you expecting that?
Well, I asked for it, to be perfectly honest, because I know the power that the Rules Committee carries, and so I was delighted that Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg granted me my request.
And why did you want to be on the Rules Committee?
Really because, like I said, of the power it yields. Rules Committee is, if you will, the equivalent of an executive committee, if you will, for the Senate. Rules Committee is where bill assignments are determined, where critical issues governing the House are discussed and made. You know, it's a small committee. It's comprised of five members chaired by the pro tem. Also, very significantly, it's where confirmations occur. So it gives me an opportunity to really weigh in and express the concerns and issues my constituents may have about a particular department or agency when we have the opportunity to engage with people coming up for confirmation, either gubernatorial appointees or department heads.
Okay, and we'll get more into that later, so I'm going to save the rest of my questions until then. But going back to being in the Senate from the Assembly, did you bring any of your Assembly goals with you into the Senate, and if so, what are they?
Yes, I did. We spent quite a bit of time when I first got to the Assembly convening constituent groups. We have what we call community cabinets, and it's a group of folks I meet with, my staff meet with on a quarterly basis, who are subject matter experts but are constituents. And so they range, we've got community cabinets ranging from education to health to small business and the environment. Those community cabinets have been really instrumental in helping me really frame goals and objectives for not only my term of service, but also for the Senate district. Given term limits, I wanted to be able to, once I term out, look back over my term of service and say, you know, what were we really able to accomplish? What did my constituents experience as a result of having supported me to be their elected official. And so we've come up with, you know, a real clear set of goals that really govern our district engagement, my legislative package, the kinds of committees I've asked to serve on. And so that really does continue to provide me and my staff with focus and direction.
What are those goals?
Well, the goals are really summarized by one sentence. Healthy families, healthy communities leads to a healthy California. And we define health really kind of organically. It's not just, you know, what you might think of in terms of one's physical health, but it's the community's health. The community's health is governed by working families being able to have healthy school environments, you know, healthy air, a healthy general fund for the state, a healthy economy, and public safety. And so those are the areas that we really are focusing because I'm clear that they are priorities for my constituents.
So it's more than just health in the literal sense of the word.
Exactly. It's a much more, I think, kind of organic, expansive. You know, when you think about a healthy community, you think about a community that's environmentally healthy, where public safety is at the top of our agenda, as well as environmentally healthy.
Okay. And one more question on this, and then we'll move on. And that is, did you bring any bills that you wanted to get through the Assembly but didn't into the Senate for you to try to get through?
Yes, I did. I got to tell you, Max, I'm very proud of one statistic or fact, that every bill for the first 3 years that I served in the Assembly that I actually got to the governor's desk, he signed. And so I've got a really good batting average once I get bills to his desk. There were a couple of critical policy issues that we started in the Assembly that didn't get through the process that we've reintroduced this year. One having to do with CalWORKS, something called the Maximum Family Grant. It's an issue where advocates have coalesced around really focusing on trying to eliminate child poverty in the state of California. California has the highest child poverty rate in the nation. So we've reintroduced our Maximum Family Grant. We've reintroduced our bill to create a moratorium on fracking, which is a critical issue for the residents of the 26th District, as it was for my Assembly District, recognizing that the Inglewood oil fields is the largest urban oil field in the country, in addition to some smaller oil fields in the West Adams, Jefferson Park area surrounding your very campus. Mm-hmm. And so we've reintroduced the fracking moratorium. And thirdly, we've reintroduced a bill to really try to help state workers live a healthier lifestyle, where we're looking at extending the sunset on a bill that requires that vending machines in state buildings have a certain percentage of healthy food options available to state employees. So those are the three issues that we had introduced in the Assembly, couldn't quite hit a home run on them, and so we've reintroduced them now that we're in the Senate.
And the governor seems very... I wouldn't say necessarily against, but he doesn't seem like he would impose a fracking moratorium. What are you going to try to do to convince him?
Well, I think this is an issue that is picking up steam, literally and figuratively. This year, unlike last year, we're working very closely with a tight coalition of environmental advocacy organizations. There is a whole new community of activists in the expanded now district that I represent that are fully engaged. The state Democratic Party just this past weekend included a desire to have a moratorium on fracking and acidization until such time as those practices are deemed safe in the state party platform. And so I think the issue, the general public's understanding and concern around the issue are expanding, and folks are going to talk to their elected leaders and express their concern. So I think that the time has come for California to have a real critical, keen look at this policy, and I believe the governor, as all elected leaders, will take note and be responsive to their constituents.
If for some reason the governor is not, would you be willing to lead a vote to overturn his veto?
That's a great, great question. And, you know, that would depend largely on the kind of momentum and interest we have from the legislature. You know, a veto override requires a supermajority 2/3. Mm-hmm. And it has not been done in many, many years, certainly not under this current governor's administration or under his current gubernatorial administration. And so it would depend. We would have to see what kind of legislative interest we have in this area, and if I've got the votes to get it off the floor and off the Senate floor and the Assembly floor, that suggests that we would have two-thirds. That would certainly be something I would be interested in looking at.
Okay.
It would also have a lot to do with the desires of our legislative leaders in both houses.
That is true. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to move on now and talking about your 26th senatorial district, which turns into the 30th district next year. It covers a large area and encompasses multiple communities, many of which have different interests and different population makeups. What is it like representing a district like that, and how are you able to balance the wants, the needs, and what is best for the various population groups within your district?
That's a great question, and I think that's a challenge that all of my colleagues, particularly my Senate colleagues, experience. You know, California is such a diverse state, and Senate districts are really quite large, Max. They're, you know, one of the largest kind of elected bodies in the country. Our state Senate district in California is, you know, maybe three times the size of a congressional district. We have just under 1 million people in each state Senate district. And through redistricting, the process focuses on making sure that each district is about the same size, so all of us represent about the same number of people. So with that, it's important for me to, you know, keep my eyes and ears open and keep in as close contact as I can with my constituents. That's why, you know, I work very hard to have a Cracker Jack district office team. The district office staff, their primary role is to help me keep their finger on the pulse of what's going on in the district. And so my district office staff are kind of divided geographically and by issue area, and are engaged and in the district, you know, full time, 24/7. I'm there weekly. When I'm done conducting my business on behalf of my constituents here in Sacramento, I'm at home in my district, attending meetings, hosting town halls, making sure that I'm aware of what's going on.
If, for example, someone, your district goes, for those that don't know, into Century City, if a group in Century City and that bulk of your constituency really wants something, but your bulk in by the USC's area doesn't want something, what will you do?
You know, that's a great question, and one that every elected leader in every level of government, you know, faces. And ironically, Max, I think the incidence of constituents agreeing far outnumbers the kind of scenario that you paint. You know, case in point, I strongly believe that improving issues around health and safety and education and jobs anywhere in the 26th district helps improve the quality of life for all of my constituents, and they all support that. No matter if you live in the Hollywood Hills versus Leimert Park versus Culver City, everybody wants clean air, high-quality schools, safe communities for their kids. But specifically, transportation, I think, is a good example of an issue area that I've worked on that really spans the district across the board from north to south, east to west. So the Expo Line expansion, for example, you know, the Crenshaw Line and the subway, which, you know, I'm knocking on wood, will be completed, you know, at least within my lifetime, would go from the beach to downtown, hopefully to LAX. And everybody across the district wants less traffic, less smog. We want to be able to transport consumers to business all along the business corridor and the Crenshaw corridor and other places. And so I think that those are examples of regional public policy issues that people support and want to see improvement, whatever community they may live in my Senate district.
Okay, and I have two questions. Maybe it will be the same answer for both. If one of your constituents from the southern portion of your district, so Leimert Park or south, was to come up and ask you how you have had a direct positive effect on their way or quality of life in the 26th, what would you say? And what would you say if a constituent from Century City asked you the same question?
Great question, Max. You know, I'm a product of Leimert Park, and so I'm proud of when I do get constituents that come up to me and either give me a way to go pat on the back or challenge me to think deeper and work a little harder on their behalf. I think the fracking moratorium is a perfect example of that, where Culver City residents, folks in Beverly Hills who live around Beverly High and have the oil drilling right there, some in my district, some outside of the district, to constituents around the USC area in West Adams and Jefferson Park have all come and been very supportive of the fracking moratorium. But I think in a perfect example is because of the acidization process that they're using in the oil wells in the West Adams area, and that was an issue for those constituents, we were able to expand our moratorium bill to focus on that issue as well. So I think that that might be a good example of where residents from the south to the west, as well as the easternmost section of the district, recognize a critical issue that's impacting potentially their public health and has given them great cause for concern. I also think my work on the budget, I was budget subcommittee chair in the assembly of the Health and Human Services area. My current work on public safety committee, looking at L.A. County's plan for realignment and how we're negotiating reentry services. I think folks in Leimert Park would feel very strongly about the work I've done on foster care and health and human services as well.
Okay, and you believe that those examples are things that people in Century City would be happy with as well?
Absolutely. Based on town halls and based on my budget town hall that I convene every year where we get Century City residents, you know, I think the Century City section of the district is most concerned about the transportation example I cited earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think the fracking issue is really a regional issue. I think sometimes we think communities, either based on their socioeconomic or ethnic composition, are very different. But again, many of these issues are regional issues. Transportation is a perfect example. I think that folks would support the policy positions I've taken on those issues, and they certainly have reflected it in their wonderful support of me on Election Day at the polls.
Okay, and I want to go back to your transportation comment for just one moment. And the Purple Line extension is the subway to the sea, and will end, right now it's scheduled to end in Westwood, but the goal is to make it to Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
And although Beverly Hills isn't your district, it's scheduled right now to run underneath Beverly Hills High School.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of where it ends in Century City.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a position on where you'd like it to end in Century City?
I don't. Most of the conversation that I've been engaged in so far is just really, again, trying to make sure that we have the resources to pay for it to ultimately get to its final destination. And so I don't have a specific position right now on where it should end temporarily because, again, we're hoping that ultimately the ultimate vision is for it to go from downtown to the sea. Lots of conversations have taken place in my office, and I've been involved in the discussions around grade level, below ground, that piece, issues around public safety, issues around, concerns around intensifying traffic at major intersections where the train will run at grade level, and issues around, gas and oil going below ground in certain areas of L.A. City isn't prudent just because of, the natural gas and oil that continues to be beneath our streets. So those are conversations we're continuing to have.
Okay, and do you know if you will eventually or when you expect to have a position on where you'd like it to stop in Century City?
You know, we'll continue to be engaged in the public process, the public meeting process with MTA. I certainly don't have a seat on MTA, but I send staff to the meetings, and we've communicated with MTA on a variety of issues from making sure that there's a stop in Leimert Park on the Crenshaw Line. And so I don't have a specific date, but as those decisions are being made, we'll certainly weigh in and we'll engage our constituents, and I want to hear from them in terms of their concerns. These are very political, hot potato kind of decisions, and I have a track record of ultimately weighing in, and we'll do so again.
Okay, and I want to go back to the Rules Committee just briefly, and I know we're running short on time, but for those that do not know, does the Rules Committee put any bills on before the floor? Or are there any bills that go before the Senate Rules Committee? Excuse me.
Well, not that I'm aware of. What rules does is assign the committees that all bills that come to the legislature go to.
Okay.
And so we are sort of, like I said, the executive committee or the administrative arm of the Senate. So we make the assignments. Rules Committee doesn't necessarily carry bills, but Rules Committee makes a recommendation for bill assignments. The Rules Committee makes recommendations on committee assignments for members. The Rules Committee will make a recommendation on confirmations that sometimes then go to the full to the floor for a full vote.
Okay. And quickly, because it is the governing body of the Senate, there are two senators, Calderon and Wright, who have gotten in trouble lately, and some might say the Senate did not react when it should have. Why didn't the Senate take action sooner to suspend or remove or give sanctions to these senators?
Well, I'm sorry that that's kind of the public misperception about what the legislature did. Both members have taken voluntary leaves of absence until they complete kind of the judicial process of their individual and very distinct cases. So it would be premature for the Senate to take any kind of final action on their ability to serve in the Senate without, you know, a final judicial ruling.
But you said they took voluntary leaves of absences. Do you believe the Senate should have acted before they took those voluntary leaves?
No, because the Senate really has very limited power in terms of what we could do. We could expel them. If we expel them, that's permanent. If we expel them and the two gentlemen finish, you know, go through their complete kind of judicial process and are either found innocent or are not charged with crimes that would justify expulsion from the Senate, then we would have acted prematurely. So I think the Senate followed the rules of our House. Fortunately, they voluntarily took leaves of absence. If they hadn't, the Senate may have taken some action, but expulsion is really what we have the power to do, and it's premature for the Senate to do that until both of them complete their cases through the judicial process.
Is there any worry that these two senators ruin the integrity of the office?
Oh, by no means. No. I think that throughout the course of history in any sector, in public office, in any sector, there are individuals that may experience, you know, legal challenges. Again, I'll say that the two cases are very, very different. Senator Wright's case, of which a jury has taken action, but a judge has not made a final ruling, has to do with a very technical interpretation of, you know, domicile, where one lives when you represent your constituents. It's clearly a section of the law that's quite ambiguous that I think the legislature is going to take action on because, for example, members of Congress don't have to live in their districts. They just have to live in the state. Mm-hmm. And so that's a area of ambiguity of the law that a number of other legislators are facing or in Senator Wright's exact same predicament but have not been charged by their DAs in their respective counties. And so that's a rather technical issue that I think the court will ultimately make a ruling on, and the legislature may choose to take up to provide more clarity in the law. Senator Calderon has only been charged, has not gone through the court process, and so once that's completed, we'll see. I've not heard any expressed concern from my constituents about those two gentlemen because I think my constituents understand that they vote for me and elect me to represent them, and all of my colleagues, including those two gentlemen, take our jobs very seriously in terms of representing Californians who elect us. It is an honor to serve. We take an oath and work very hard every day to make decisions that we believe are in their best interest.
Okay. And moving on now to one of your other committees, as you mentioned earlier, you were also on the budget. What were your thoughts of Governor Brown's budget proposal, and what are your committee's thoughts?
So I'm serving this year. I was appointed to Budget Subcommittee Number 5, which focuses on corrections and the courts.
Mm-hmm.
My overall comment about the budget is it's great news. We have a surplus to the tune of $6.4 billion, and that's a conservative estimate. We'll have numbers that are much more accurate in the governor's May revise after all of us pay our income taxes in April. Mm-hmm. So I think it's wonderful news compared to what I experienced when I first came to the legislature, where we were still having to make deep, deep cuts in order to pass a balanced on-time budget, which we did do, but at the sacrifice of many, many critical safety net education programs that Californians need and are entitled to. So I think the first blush response is it's great news. Secondly, now we have to really talk about the value statement of our budget. I believe, you know, the budget is represents our values as a state. We value having savings. Yes, we value spending down debt. So, you know, my son and your future children don't have to, you know, pay the debt that we incurred. But we also need to invest again. And so I think there's certainly enough resources to do all three. So the discussion and the debate will focus on how we make that happen and what critical services and resources we allocate to, again, reinvest in California's future.
Okay. And you mentioned you're on subcommittee dealing with the courts and the prison system, and you're also on the public safety. And you talk about values. Does the budget then give you the indication that we have a value for incarceration in this state? Because the governor is spending a large amount of money on incarceration and leasing out beds and prison infill projects.
Well, I think what the budget reflects is a court decision based on the fact that we didn't value, I think, for far too many years, the humane treatment of people we incarcerate. And so we're, you know, the health services under the Department of Corrections is under a receiver who has mandated through the court process that we increase our funding for health services for inmates, because for far too long we didn't provide appropriate health services. I think, you know, the passage of the three strikes law, many of the indeterminate sentences in the secure housing unit, it does reflect an attitude about those who are incarcerated, which I don't think is a healthy one, which is why I'm focusing on using the realignment dollars appropriately for reentry, so we can try to reduce our ridiculously high recidivism rate, provide services to inmates while they're locked up, so when they are released, they have other options available to them. So, for example, I'm hosting a town hall meeting this Saturday in partnership with Congresswoman Karen Bass and my colleague Assemblyman Reggie Jones Sawyer to talk about the reentry services in our collective district, in our respective districts, and how we can support community and nonprofit organizations in providing critical services. You know, the courts have told the governor that we were overpopulated.
Mm-hmm. But regardless of what the court said, but don't you think it is wrong that we're spending this much on building prisons and with incarceration rather than building and maintaining the infrastructure for rehabilitation and other services to make sure that these people that don't necessarily belong in jail can get the proper help?
I couldn't agree with you more, Max, and I think I've got, you know, a bill package and a voter record in public safety that agrees with you. The only caveat I would add is until such time that we can reduce the population in prison, we have to make sure that the people who are locked up are treated humanely. Mm-hmm. And so while we say we don't want to spend more money building prisons, and we do want to put more money into prevention services and into reducing recidivism, there is a population today that we have to deal with, and I think it's inhumane to house people quadruple bunked in very tight, small quarters. And so whatever we have to do to shift that population and manage that population today so they're experiencing a more humane existence is important to me as well. I agree that we shouldn't direct money on building new infrastructure, but we have to address that issue.
Okay. And I personally think Governor Brown's one of the luckier governors in this union because the federal judges have allowed him to extend the deadline or have extended the deadline for reduction in the population. Just a quick yes or no answer because we're running short on time. Do you believe he should have been held in contempt of court?
No.
Okay. And moving, one last question before we run out of time. At the California Democratic Convention, Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones said that he would like California to have a single-payer health care option or a health care plan. What are your thoughts on that, and is your committee doing anything as a member of the Insurance Committee? Is your committee doing anything to get us there?
We have not yet convened an Insurance Committee hearing yet this year. Our first committee meeting will take place in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two, I think down the road, single-payer hopefully will be a best option, not only for the state of California, but the nation. But in the meantime, I'm putting forth all of my energy and all my focus in making sure that the Affordable Care Act is implemented well and the 2 million people that have already signed up get access to services, and then the next 2 weeks we have for open enrollment to get as many Californians enrolled as possible. That's where my energy and focus lies currently.
Okay, thank you very much for that, and thank you very much for joining me in the hot seat today, Senator Mitchell. It was a pleasure having you. We would love to have you on before the end of your term.
Thanks, Max. Please invite me back, and I'll be here.
Absolutely, we will do that. The Hot Seat After Hours starts right now. You can email the Hot Seat inbox at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at maxschwartztv. You can also read and follow my blog at maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. You can subscribe to the Hot Seat's newsletter by clicking on the link on our page. Go to annenbergradio.org/podcast, click on the link underneath the Hot Seat's description, and enter your email address. Thank you for listening. I will let you know that the Hot Seat's pre-primary blitz is going to start, which means you may not be hearing me for a while. I will be interviewing candidates running for the 3rd District seat on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. I will be interviewing candidates running for Los Angeles County Sheriff and candidates running for the 62nd Assembly District. I will not be posting candidate interviews until after all of the candidates for that specific race or all who have agreed to call in have been interviewed because I want to make sure everything is fair and equal. However, I may be having some other guests call in as well. Those interviews will be posted right away. So until next time, good day.